This is Nancy Dwyer.
And Rocky Alvey.
For Stellar Conversations, recorded at Vanderbilt University's Dyer Observatory.
I'm Rick Chappell, and I'm the director of the Dyer Observatory. We have a wonderful stellar conversation today with Major General Charles Bolden, who was a NASA astronaut and had a distinguished career in the Marine Corps. I was lucky enough to be able to train as a backup payload specialist on a mission that Charlie was the commander of, and it was a wonderful experience for me. Charlie, welcome.
Good to be here, Rick. Thanks very much for the invitation.
One of the things about human spaceflight, I think, and exploration maybe in general, that people are not as aware of has to do with the human interaction part of things. Talk about some of the challenges and some of the considerations of bringing a crew of people together to work as a unit under pressure and all that sort of thing.
It's an interesting activity, and the fortunate thing, I think, was that you were a part of the team that we had that we brought together for a mission that was called Atlas, a very disparate team. We, as you remember, we had academicians and scientists and people like me who were pilots, and it ran the gamut, all type A personalities. And then a very important part of the team that is never talked about were the spouses and the families. I thought it was so important when you and I worked together to make sure that we understood each other that I actually consulted with a psychiatrist, a guy by the name of, I forget what Terry's last name was, to be quite honest, but actually brought him in and asked him to sit with us and talk a little bit about personality types. And if I remember correctly, we actually did the written test and everything so that we could be categorized. Yeah. And because I wanted everybody on the crew to know what we were all like and who we were psychologically, so that if something happened, heaven forbid, that we would know how each other was likely to react to that, and that we would be able to respond in the proper way. So I think there's a lot more involved in bringing disparate people like that together than most people think. Most people think they just throw us together as a crew and we train and we go fly and we forget about it. But you become a family, as I think you recognized when you were there. And families have difficult times. And when you're together for a year or more, as most crews are, then you become more and more family. So it's truly bringing together. I think you bring many families together to make one flight crew family.
So. I know one of the aspects of it that was so important was your leadership and the tone that you set for us, and the sort of the warmth of the ambiance of our being together. Talk a little about just leadership things, just considerations, approaches that end up blending people as opposed to.
First of all, I think you're very kind in saying that. I was basically just trying to do what I had seen my mom and dad do and what I had seen some of my other mentors in the Marine Corps. Again, we always thought that family was a big deal, and felt that it was much easier to go to space to do something that is risky. We kind of downplay it most of the time, I think, but it is risky, and we felt that it would be much easier to do this risky thing if the families were relatively at ease with what we were doing, if they were very comfortable around each other, and if each crew member felt confident that NASA was going to take care of their families if something happened. And NASA goes to the great extent of assigning astronaut representatives with each crew that we call family escorts. And they have one person, a civil servant, who's assigned to actually be with the spouses all the time when we go down to the Kennedy Space Center, and then if we go out to Edwards for a landing. So my background in the Marine Corps, and I think NASA's experience, has said that you really do want to make everybody feel as comfortable as possible, because as you go along in the training cycle and as we got farther into the flights, it stopped being routine for people who thought, you know, it might be routine, and everybody realized how serious it was, particularly after Challenger. Absolutely. And so it was very important for for us all to come together as a family, realizing the risk, but realizing that if something happened, people would be taken care of. That was critical.
You mentioned the risk. Talk a little bit, and you were fortunate enough to fly four times. Talk about the thought process leading into a flight, dealing with the risk. How did you approach that?
My first flight, I think the approach wasn't cavalier by any stretch of the imagination, because I was an experienced test pilot. So I'd lived through 12 years of just being a pilot, a military pilot. I'd gone through Vietnam, where you realize that every night you went out, somebody was shooting at you, trying to stop what you were doing, just as you were trying to stop what they were doing. So risk was not strange to me by any stretch of the imagination. But it was a little bit different when I came to NASA. And you were talking about risk in spaceflight, something that was chosen. In the military, the choice you make is being in the military. And then after that, you don't choose whether you go to combat here or you go to combat there. You go where they send you. In NASA, it's a choice, and it's a choice as to whether you even try to become an astronaut. And then once you do, you always have the opportunity to say, okay, I've had enough, and I'm ready to go home. I think a big part of being willing to take the risk was our fervent belief that what we were doing as explorers was worth the while, worth the risk. I had the privilege of being both at Vanderbilt and at Fisk during my visit, this visit to Nashville. And you may recall when we were with the kids at Fisk, we talked about no pain, no gain, which is something they can relate to, because a lot of them were athletes and just students who were into things that took a lot of work and a lot of pain in reaching goals that they had set for themselves. It's the same way in the space program. You've really got to work hard, but you've got to believe in what you're doing. Otherwise, I don't think your mind will let you take the risk. And we've had people who left the program after one flight, because they either felt fully satisfied or they felt that, boy, this is a little bit more than I think I can handle. And so I've done my due, and I'm ready to go home.
One of the things that I felt in a very small way, not actually being able to fly, is the feeling that when you're in the exploration business, and particularly in a circumstance in which there's life-threatening things involved, that it causes you to think about life in a different way. It's like you have a broader view, or things, the little things of life that might drive us nuts in certain circumstances they're not on the radar screen anymore. Yeah. How does that strike you?
I agree with you entirely. And as a matter of fact, there have been, probably at least three and maybe four experiences in my life that have really drilled that home. The first was probably flying in Vietnam when I recognized the fact that everything could end just in the twinkling of an eye, but I was doing something I enjoyed doing and that I thought was really worthwhile. But it teaches you, that taught me that you live every bit that you can today, because you don't really realize what God has in the plan for you. My time in the space program was really different in that once you got on orbit and looked back at Earth and saw it from that perspective, the beauty of this thing this planet that we call home, is just unbelievable. Awesome is an overused word, but we don't have another. I can't think of another word in the English language that adequately describes the view, the experience, the exhilaration that you get from looking at our home planet from the vantage point of space. And in my case, I felt small. I've heard other people say how big they felt. I really felt small and insignificant, because you look down at Earth and there's not a lot of indication that humans live there. It's like God, it's the day before God decided he wanted to put Adam and Eve on Earth or something like that. So there's this planet down there and it's looking great, and humans haven't come to ruin it yet. That's sort of the feeling you get. And again, that makes you appreciative of every single day. The third thing in my life was actually when my son had his first kid and I became a grandparent for the first time. There's something about, there's a great thing about being a parent. There's something about being a grandparent that, again, makes you understand that, your time is limited. You've been blessed to have these things that you can help mold. And so you really want to do all you can in the brief period of time that you have left with them. They're not fatalist feelings or anything, but they're just a realization that God has given everybody a certain amount of time, and you don't know what that time is. And so you really need to do something. I use a passage from a young South African kid by the name of Nkosi Johnson, who died at the age of 12 of AIDS. And when he was interviewed by a national public radio and ABC journalist, Jim Wooten, Jim asked him how could he do what he did and how could he always remain so excited and how could he continually busy himself with making his village and his world better when he knew he was going to die. And he said, you do all you can with what you have and the time that you have and the place that you are. And those are pretty profound words for a 12-year-old, but they speak very well to the various experiences that I've had in my life that keep reminding me, okay, you don't know what tomorrow's going to be like, so do something good today. Don't go out and be cavalier, but do something to make a difference today, because you know you want to leave something behind that says the world's going to be a little bit better than it was when you pass through here today.
Absolutely. Well, jumping back from this perspective, the apex of your career, at least in altitude, the view from orbit, and being in the exploration business, mm-hmm. Can you cycle back to your childhood and find things that made you begin to think about exploration and being in some sort of career like
that? I never dreamed of being an astronaut when I was a child growing up in South Carolina. I never even dreamed of flying airplanes, but I did always. I always wanted to be outdoors, and I always wanted to be out doing something new and different, something that was exciting and challenging. And I think I got that from my mom and dad. They always encouraged they insisted with my brother and me that we study. That was number one. They were school teachers, and so we didn't have any problem with our teachers being supported. We knew that if we didn't study and we didn't obey in school, then we were going to be in big trouble. And I had a couple of examples of that over the course of my time in school. So the studying was something that was mandatory. But they always told us that we could do anything we wanted to do. They emphasized to us when we were growing up in the 50s and 60s in South Carolina that people may tell you there are things you can't do, and you may get the idea from looking at other people or looking at circumstances around you that there are things you can't do, but don't believe it, because if you're willing to study and work really hard, you can do anything you want to do. So I was always out and about. I made a point of looking for programs in the summertime that would take me away from South Carolina, where I could do things academically that I wasn't able to do in my own schools. And I was fortunate enough to have two summers consecutively before I graduated from high school, where I was able to go to National Science Foundation summer programs, and one of them in computer science and another one in chemistry, where I was exposed to things that I never would have seen in my high school, you know, in Richland School District 1 back in the 50s. So I think it was mainly my parents' influence that said, get out, explore, find out what's out there in the world. My mother was a librarian, and her favorite way to explore was through books. So I was a rabid reader as a child. I stopped reading shortly after coming out of the Naval Academy, and then I started reading again, and then I stopped after going to test pilot school, because you just, when you get in these intense environments where you're reading all the time, you just get tired. I've started reading again, but that was the one thing that my mother always taught us, that you can travel anywhere in the world that you want to if you're willing to open the pages of a book. So she taught me to explore that way. And then I think it's just the experience of reading about what other people have done and places that other people have gone that makes you hungry to go see it for yourself. And that's just the way I've always been. So I chose the Naval Academy because I wanted to go into the Navy, because I heard, you join the Navy and see the world. So I think it was just exploring was something that's always been in my genes.
Now, today, children face a very different environment than we faced when we were in, let's say, middle school, high school, and beginning to think about what we might do. How do you assess opportunities for kids today as far as the possibility of being an explorer?
I think the opportunities for a kid today, or the possibility of being an explorer, are far more vast than they were when you and I came along. I mean, just the ability to travel, to meet people of fame and fortune, that happens today to kids almost on a whim. You know, when I grew up, there was no astronaut coming to my hometown. Today, astronauts hopefully, you know, travel all over the place and seek to get in and work with school kids to try to get them fired up about wanting to not necessarily become astronauts, but wanting to get into science and technology. The opportunities to go do things through camps. You offer a phenomenal one here, you know, at the observatory, just looking at the pictures here at the kids who've come in and with their teachers. Those are opportunities that didn't exist when I was growing up in South Carolina. So I think the opportunity to be an explorer and the impetus to be an explorer is far greater today because of people who do what you do and what the Exploration Society does, people who push kids to want to get out and do many of the things that we only wish we could have done. And I say that as somebody who's been in space, but I've never walked on another planet. I didn't go to the moon. There are a lot of things that humans have done, but I didn't get a chance to do, and I would love to do. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is that I'm probably not going to do that, but I would love to see my granddaughter do it or see some of the kids that we are privileged to talk to when we go to school, see them have an opportunity to do that because it's just, you know, time wasn't right for you and me to have an opportunity to do that. But if we can inspire a young kid to want to do it the way that we did, then I think we've done something pretty good. And kids have a lot of people like us who do try to get them excited about the fields of science and math and so they can become explorers.
People often talk about the space program as they're not quite sure what we get out of it. back when we were going to the moon, it was clear there was a race. We were battling with the Soviets. We needed to show America's ability internationally and in technology and exploration, and that we don't seem to feel that quite as much anymore. What are your thoughts on why we should do space exploration?
I look back on the Apollo era, for example, and the times that we were involved in the moon race, and everybody thought, I think everybody felt that that was the reason we needed to do it. Not many people had a realization of all the things, tangible things, that were going to come out of the preparation for that. Every time I see an ambulance go by and I think about what's going on between that ambulance and the hospital, it's probably 20 miles away where the doctors are looking at the vital signs from the patient who's in the ambulance. That's because we needed a way to tell what was going on in the bodies of astronauts who were 250,000 miles away on the surface of the moon. So we started doing, using radio waves to transmit vital signs from the human body. And we now do telemedicine and those kinds of things. There's more than Velcro and Tang that came out of the space program. And every day we use things. I give the example of the laptop. The first time I ever saw a laptop computer, and maybe I'm just came from the country or something, but I remember when we started using this thing that was called a grid, laptop, when we started doing Earth observations from space, and we needed a way to enable the crew to look at sites that were coming up in the next orbit so they could get their cameras ready and everything. And we couldn't take a computer aboard, so we took a miniature computer that became known as a laptop. Those kinds of things were developed out of necessity. And that's frequently what happens with exploration. Explorers need a way to get from point A to point B and get there quicker or more efficiently or be able to communicate with people that they left behind. And so we develop things that help us do that. And those are serendipitous things that we didn't plan on, but we find necessary. Every once in a while, we make some true discoveries, things that we didn't plan on, weren't necessary, but we stumbled across, you know. But that's the benefit of exploration, and because it's the things that you don't know that are always, I think, the things that you appreciate the most.
One of the biggest grand challenges that America could decide to undertake would be to send Americans to Mars. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's necessary. I think it's vital. I think I'm not sure it's going to be Americans only. I think it's going to. I just think that spaceflight has become so incredibly expensive, and things in general, we tend to do much better when we do them cooperatively. it takes the race away when you unite with other nations in a project the way that we did with the International Space Station. Was that smooth? No. Do things go well all the time? No. But is it vital that we have an International Space Station where people from multiple nations can venture off the planet and go do things to help us understand the way that we live better, the way that the human body functions better, help us understand a lot of things that are much better and much quicker than we can do down here when we're constrained by gravity or the forces that gravity exerts on us that keep us from seeing some natural laws in action the way that you can when you're in a microgravity environment. So I think Mars is critical. And do I think we'll do it? Yes, I do. When? I hope within the next 15 to 20 years. But I can't be certain because, as I mentioned to some people before, if you'd asked me 20 years ago when I first came to the space program, would we be on Mars now? I said yes. And I really thought we would. I thought average human beings would be flying in space by 2005. I thought by the year 2000. Space tourism, if you will, what we call space tourism today. I thought that routine space flight, quote unquote routine, because space flight is never routine, but I thought that normal human beings, non-career astronauts, would be able to fly in space by 2000 at the rate that we were going when I first came to the space program. And then Challenger came along and took away mainly our will. And our determination to overcome the obstacles of getting to space and traveling far away from Earth to another planet.
We've been talking with Charlie Baldwin, former NASA astronaut and general in the Marine Corps of the United States, a wonderful explorer and a very special role model for kids across the spectrum today. Charlie, thank you very much.
Rick, thanks very much for letting me be with you again.
This is Nancy Dwyer.
And Rocky Alvey.
For Stellar Conversations, brought to you by Vanderbilt University's Public Affairs Department and recorded at Vanderbilt Dyer Observatory.